Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's special series, The Authoritarian Playbook. On November 21st, 2022, Donald Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was speaking with a journalist just days after Democrats did better than expected in the midterm elections. He was sharing his advice for Republicans running for office in 2024. He said, quote, "I get asked, who's the most dangerous person in the world? Is it Chairman Kim? Is it Xi Jinping? The most dangerous person in the world," he said, "is Randy Weingarten. It's not a close call." Randy Weingarten is a former social studies teacher turned union leader. In her new book, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education, and the Future of Democracy, today's guest, Randy Weingarten, writes, quote, "Why would the former Secretary of State, who has literally sat across the table from demagogues and dictators, call a 5-foot-tall Jewish lesbian grandmother union leader who's married to a rabbi the most dangerous person in the world? It makes sense when you understand that Pompeo was utilizing a broader strategy, blame teachers over and over again, truth be damned, in order to divide the American people and defund and destabilize public education," end quote. Randy Weingarten says her new book is a love letter to public school educators and an expose of the well-funded strategy behind the vilification of teachers and the war on knowledge. Throughout history, dictators and fascists have gone after teachers. Because education empowers people to think for themselves, attacks on education are central to the authoritarian playbook. Randy Weingarten says we all need to fight back to save and strengthen public education. We hear a lot about religious and private schools, but as she points out in her book, 90% of school children attend public schools. Randy Weingarten has been president of the American Federation of Teachers since 2008. AFT is a union of educators, healthcare professionals, and public service workers. For 10 years prior, Randy Weingarten headed the United Federation of Teachers, the union representing educators in New York City's public schools. And before that, she taught social studies at Clara Barton High School in New York. Randy Weingarten's new book is called Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education, and the Future of Democracy. Hi, Randy. Thank you so much for writing this new book, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, my God. I'm so honored to join you. And, I have a great respect for authors after going through the process of writing and publishing a book.
Oh, my gosh. I bet. It's funny you say that because we've had a number of authors on recently, and because you just read so fast, at least I try to read really fast, you forget about how much work goes into these books.
Oh my God.
It's a lot.
I am not sure if I knew how much work, I had a sense of it, but if I knew how, I'm not sure I will ever do it again. Let me just say this. I can't believe that I did this. But the process of writing, and the process of reflecting, and the process of thinking, on some levels, it was an amazing process, and it gave me an opportunity to really think about things that have happened in terms of policies in the United States, and how to do better and how to be better. And so I'm a more reflective person today after writing the book.
Well, before we dive into the book, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got to this point? You actually taught social studies at Clara Barton High School in New York.
Yeah.
Why did you become a teacher?
So my mother was a teacher, and my sister and I both thought, I have one sister, we both thought that teachers worked so hard and so many hours, neither one of us were interested initially in teaching, because we watched my mother every single day bring papers home. She was basically, she loved second grade. She went to third grade 1 year and really hated it and wanted to go back to second grade. She used to say, I want to be left back in second grade. And she always worked. And and then ultimately, both my sister, who became a doctor, and I, who became a lawyer, went back into wanting to teach because of that. The essential nature of what you do as a teacher is that it's connection with young people, basically, and where you're very much focused on the future and their opportunity and how you help seed it in lots of different ways. And so, you know, I went to college thinking about being a lawyer, thinking about that was the way in which I could make a difference in the lives of people. I always wanted to make a difference in the lives of people. And I ultimately went to my mother had been on strike when I was, I guess, a junior or senior, junior, I think, in high school. 6-week strike. We also had the 70s fiscal crisis all over the country, as those who are alive then know, you know, the gas struggles, the fiscal crisis, all of those things. And so I kept thinking that working people, that the labor movement would be, you know, the best place to try to make a difference in the lives of people. And I was really lucky that I kind of got to the intersection of schooling and labor. I left a big law firm to actually work at the teachers union in New York City, and felt like, and this is where that, you know, my mother's influence kind of gnawed at me. I felt like you had to really be able to close your eyes and walk in the shoes of the people you represented in order to represent people, that you couldn't just come to it from the outside. You had to really understand it. And I just loved teaching. I loved high school teaching. I loved my kids, who were, you know, basically all Black and brown kids from, you know, New York City's Crown Heights section of Brooklyn. And we used to compete in national debate competitions, state debate competitions, city debate competitions. I taught AP Gov, and, you know, U.S. history. And, you know, even with all the frustrations of being in a school system where you were scavenging for chalk sometimes, and where, you know, I basically reprinted all the materials that I was using in class at a outside print shop that was on my way to school. There's no better job, I think, than that kind of connection that you have with young people, and the kind of work you can do teaching kids how to think and have the agency and the confidence so that they can fly.
What I really love about your book, and let's start talking first about the love letter aspect of your book rather than the dark parts of your book, Randy, because so much is dark right now and people are overwhelmed by the news. I really love how you allow the reader, and this was my experience reading your book, to really just think about the importance of public education. I mean, you made me think about some of the teachers that really influenced my life. Education was just so important. And I went to public school, and I got to where I am today really because of my teachers, my parents, of course, but definitely my teachers. And you write that public schools are more than physical structures. They are the manifestation of our civic values and ideals. The belief that in a free society, free education must be available and accessible to all. The idea that young people deserve opportunities to prepare for life, college, career, and citizenship. The understanding is that in a pluralistic society, people with different beliefs and backgrounds must learn to work together and bridge differences. So can you talk about this? Because we are bombarded with people like Pompeo just attacking teachers. We're bombarded with these questions, you know, is college for everyone? And I'm thinking, as a first generation college student, that's really offensive to me, because I'm the poster child of the person who, quote, should not go to college because my parents didn't. But I'm hosting this show right now because I went to college. So this is what we're bombarded with.
Exactly.
Let's spend some time talking about just the beauty and the importance of public education.
So I'm so, let me just say, Rose, you really got what one of the lessons I was trying to teach by writing this. I am trying to actually engage people in a critical thinking exercise, as opposed to like the, I know we're going to do the positive before the darkness, but even the decision I made that I would describe fascistic behavior without labeling anyone a fascist, I want people to draw their own conclusions and to get to their own conclusions and to think about things and to think maybe there is a different theory of the case here about what's going on in our country and what the importance of schools are. But the portion you just read, that is the gravamen. That is the essence of what schools are. We, you know, how many times have we heard, well, schools are for reading, writing, and arithmetic? Yes, that's true. But in an, frankly, an era of AI, schools are much more for how, you know, what we used to do for what we said were the best students, what the founders actually said all students should have, critical thinking, being able to discern fact from fiction, being able to actually interrogate an answer, understand something, see the nuance, problem solve, apply information, have an opinion based upon an analysis that is not, you know, just what you heard in the last, you know, or looked at the last meme that you looked at, that, you know, there's a difference between the kind of skills that you need to navigate life versus a kind of a sense in authoritarianism that, you know, you just follow the leader blindly and you know, spit out whatever facts the leader says. And that part of that is not just how to understand information, how to use it, how to apply it, but it's also how we live with each other. And the authoritarian playbook is about isolationism and fear and being, you know, critical of your neighbor, as opposed to loving your neighbor, as opposed to embracing the stranger, as opposed to seeing diversity as our strength, as opposed to kind of thinking about opportunity as not, you know, as limitless, that everyone can have, you know, can go through a pathway to opportunity, and that opportunity could mean easily, you know, going to become a welder or going to, you know, college to become a reporter. And, you know, the welder may actually get paid more than the reporter. Mm. So, you know, it's just, it's how you create that pluralistic society that even with differences really deeply respects each other as human beings. And that's what schools do. So schools don't just do reading, writing, and arithmetic. Schools do critical thinking. Schools, you know, try to help kids learn not only the higher order skills to be able to navigate their lives and to be able to do, you know, higher, you know, project-based instruction and all of that. But schools also are about the creation of a safe and welcoming environment in a classroom or a campus where you are able to, you know, be in a classroom with people who are different and respect each other and understand each other and those actions, frankly, are the habits of democracy. They are the muscles of democracy, because in a democratic society, you have to learn to work and live with each other. In order, because a democratic society is based upon the rule of law, which is based upon we the people, not the rule of one, and the role of the authoritarian.
Well, given what you just said, I think you're going to love the clip I'm about to play. So CBS News recently aired a report about Middle School 50 in Brooklyn, where Principal Benjamin Onaroff added debate to every class, yes, including math. And he says his school was on a list of dangerous schools. There'd been drastic enrollment declines from over 1,000 students to only 160 students. The debate experiment was wildly successful. Within a few years, test scores started to rise, enrollment increased, and the debate team started to win.
I felt like it kind of gave us an edge when we went to tournaments because we were kind of already used to it.
14-year-old Eric Williams and debate partner Anedwin Moran first found success at the local and state level.
As soon as they say from MS50, my mouth is just like...
Then last June, as eighth graders competing at the largest middle school debate tournament in the country,
Eric Williams and Anedwin Moran,
they won the national championship in policy debate.
I was so happy. I couldn't process nothing. I was really happy and excited.
When I like really snapped into it and realized what we had accomplished, it took me back to like when we was in sixth grade, where I wasn't even a registered debater. It felt like a journey worth taking.
A journey that started with a principal who believed anything was possible with debate.
There's a deep, deep pride in the school as a community hub. It's inspiring every day to walk down the block and have people say, I went to that school, and you know, keep it going.
Thanks to CBS News for that. I loved that story, Randy. It sounds like you might be familiar with this.
Yes, and I love, I just... Oh my God, I'm just getting goosebumps. But this is what, this is what project-based instruction really is about. This is what I often talk about, when people say, oh my God, what are we going to do to, schools, the test scores, all of this. I say four words: safe and welcoming. So safe and welcoming classrooms to campuses, and then engaged, relevant curriculum. So maybe that's five words. And what the principal in that school did is he figured out a way, and this is what I used to do in my AP Gov course all the time. We taught the We the People competition. We taught the We the People curriculum, which included a competition on the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, which we competed in city, state, and national competitions. And you, when you do something like debate, what it does is it actually forces kids to learn the habits and have the muscle of being able to discuss an answer, being able to not only hear the question, but either in groups or individually, discuss an answer and defend it. Mm. And in the defense of it, you're thinking, you're putting facts together. You're putting an argument together. You are trying to create a logical way of persuading someone. So then you're thinking about who you're trying to persuade and where they are and what arguments will persuade them. So you are, that is the key to critical thinking. And when kids then like it and enjoy it, they start creating a confidence about themselves, an agency about themselves. So as opposed to being woe is me or a sense of life is just too hard, it creates a can do instead of a can't do. Think about, Barack Obama. Why did he win the presidency? Because he created a sense of hope and aspiration for people, a sense that we can do. And that's what you're seeing and hearing in what the principal was saying and what those young people were saying. And you don't actually have to win the competition to be able to take those steps. Of course, it's always nice to win the competition, but even those steps in the vying for the competition create that level of of skills and confidence and agency. I just love it.
That's what I loved also, is that kids were actually engaging. And some of the kids in the report said that their confidence level increased. So they weren't just sitting there bored. And you write about this also in your book, that we have a lot of work to do, because my niece just entered high school and she said she was so bored in junior high. And I thought, oh, that's awful to be that age and to be bored. She said she just wasn't much engagement. She didn't like it at all. And that's a horrible experience for a young person to have.
Well, I think I said to you at the beginning, I was, you know, the book actually gave me the venue, or the process of writing and editing gives you, you know, time to reflect and think about, is this what I really want to say? Is this what I'm really thinking? Is this what I really want to say for eternity? And I think that both No Child Left Behind, I mean, we've had 50 or 60 years of federal education policy in this country. I won't spend the next 30 minutes kind of going through all of that. But let me just say that the first 25 years or so, and I write about this in terms of writing about Lyndon Johnson, he was a school teacher before he was before he was in the Congress and before he was the president. And at the end of the day, he understood that what kids needed, and came to Washington with a focus on how do we help level the playing field, particularly for poor kids. And that's where the first, you know, funding for public schools, Title I for poor kids, came about because of that. The same kind of impulse was behind the funding for the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act. How do we level the playing field for poor kids so that they can vie competitively with kids who are, you know, in richer districts and where their parents in poor communities are never going to be able to pay the property taxes that are needed to support schools. So the second 25 years of federal education policy was about accountability and about test scores and about, you know, and the transparency is important. We have to make sure that we know where kids are, and because if you don't know where kids are, how do you bring them to a different place? And you know, there has to be standards in terms of what we're teaching and how we're teaching it and things like that. But everything then became about the test, and it became boring as hell, excuse my language. And what's happening now, particularly not just after COVID, but frankly after 2010, when screens started being so omnipresent for kids, we're competing with the screens. So why are we not making education interesting and engaging for kids? Why are we not trying to figure out how do we engage kids in their education instead of them being bored, instead of them then going right back to the screen as opposed to reading a book?
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today we're spending the hour with Randy Weingarten. She's been president of the American Federation of Teachers since 2008. Before that, she headed the United Federation of Teachers, and she taught social studies at Clara Barton High School in New York. She's out with a new book called Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education and the Future of Democracy. She says her new book is a love letter to public school educators. It's also an expose of the well-funded strategy behind the vilification of teachers and the war on knowledge. This is Your Call special series, The Authoritarian Playbook. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we continue our Authoritarian Playbook series with AFT President Randy Weingarten. She's out with a new book, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education and the Future of Democracy. She opens her book with a history lesson about teachers resisting Nazis in Norway and makes the connections between historical authoritarian movements and today's efforts to dismantle public education. She says it is time to fight back to save and strengthen public education. The other point you really make in your book, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Randy, is that teaching is a very difficult job. You write, teaching multiplication and algebra and grammar and how to write a 5-paragraph essay is challenging enough. Teachers also do everything we can to meet the needs of children who arrive at school with everything from empty stomachs to emotional distress to different learning styles and behavioral challenges. Then there's the cell phone, social media distractions, and a crisis of anxiety and loneliness among youth. All of this as teachers are underpaid and public schools are under-resourced. I was also thinking about how teachers now have to have a potential gun shooting plan in place. I mean, which is really shocking. My niece and everybody who has kids in their lives know that their kids have to go through shooting drills, which teachers have to also deal with today.
It's, you know, and as you said that, I was thinking, can you imagine that we've gotten to a point where some governors like a DeSantis or an Abbott trust teachers enough to carry a gun, but don't trust them enough to actually use the books they want to use in a classroom. I mean, that's how topsy-turvy some of the politics in this country have become. But the point is that teachers always have had to deal with all of the challenges that society visits on children, all of them, and all of the challenges society visits on all of us. And whether that's violence or whether that's poverty or whether that's whatever is going on in a family's life, it all shows up in a classroom. And to pretend that it doesn't means that you don't know virtually anything about what we do as public school teachers, what happens in schools across the country, public and private. And so instead of pretending that these things don't happen, why are we not giving teachers the supports they need to help kids navigate through their lives? I mean, that's why some of us have tried to create wraparound services around schools or in schools, so that how is that that the richest country in the world can't figure out how to use its reserve funds, which they've always done, to pay for food supports? How is it that the richest country in the world can find the money to build the president his ballroom, but we can't find the money to feed children? And so so teachers are going to dig into their pockets to find ways to make sure there's no lunch shaming, so that kids can have lunch, so that kids can have breakfast. There's going to be a whole lot more, you know, donations to the food pantries that you see in lots of different schools. That's the nature of what teaching is. And if you don't deal with so many teachers, we have this expression, you know, Maslow beats Bloom all the time, which is you have to deal with primal issues. That's, you know, that's what Maslow said, before you deal with instructional issues, which is what Bloom said. So it makes the job hard even when you have all the supports, because you're basically managing a classroom of 20 to 30 different individuals. How many of us as adults manage 20 to 30 people? And so you're managing a classroom. You're trying to find the, you know, the key that's going to unlock the dreams and aspirations of all of your kids in classrooms. They're all different. And then you're also dealing with all of the, you know, the vicissitudes that society brings on us. And this is my point about Pompeo or Rufo or all of them who try to undermine public schools because they want to undermine pluralism, which is basically the fascist desire to, you know, create isolationism and to undermine communities and to undermine democracy, is that you're, a lot of teachers are doing it without any support, with the fear that if they say something wrong, if they use a kid's nicknames and the law says they're not supposed to without having, you know, gotten written permission from a parent, you know, are they going to be fired for that?
Right. Right. And we're seeing teachers under attack with the book bans. Teachers were fired for posting opinions about the killing of Charlie Kirk.
Yes.
Before we get to calls and emails, I think this is really important because it's so easy to think that opinion has really shifted because those who say the most outlandish things tend to get the microphone. But as you write in your book, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, when you look at what happened in the 2024 elections, voters in Massachusetts rejected high-stakes testing. Voters in Utah changed the state constitution to increase funding for education. California voters passed a $10 billion bond to support school and community college infrastructure. Florida voters passed funding increases all over the state. And then you had Detroit, Michigan, Toledo, Ohio, Bozeman, Montana, all passing local school funding increases. So can
exactly.
you talk about
and
this,
then,
Randy?
And then one more thing.
Yeah.
The three places, the three states where the question about vouchers were on the ballot, vouchers lost. And vouchers, when it's been on the ballot virtually everywhere, it's always lost. So when the question goes to voters, not just parents who vote, but voters, about whether you want to balkanize or support public schools for the state's students or for a city's students, virtually all the time the answer is, if that's the choice, we want to make sure that the money is there for our public schools. So when it's disconnected with, you know, just the cultural wars or the, you know, politics of Democrats versus Republican, when it's basically, do we need money for our kids, even in a period of time of tremendous crisis in affordability. So many families are struggling and suffering. People say, no, we want the money for our kids in public schools because that's our future. And, you know, over the course of the last, 40 or 50 years, you basically have 90% of kids in America still going to traditional and non-traditional public schools. You know, there's been times when religious education, has had a prominence. But even then, you had 90% of kids going to, 85 to 90% of kids going to public schools, charters. You still have 85 to 90% of kids going to traditional and non-traditional public schools. So the public schooling is part of how we pull our society together. And you saw that, frankly, in COVID, when the schools were closed because of the pandemic and how it really broke society. And, in retrospect, should we have been doing, should kids have been a priority, not bars and restaurants? Heck yes. And, would we, if we could do it over again, make sure that we had the safety protocols we needed to make sure our kids were in schools as quickly as possible? Yes. And should I have done more? We put out the first report in April of 2020 about how to get our kids back into schools in person. I kick myself for not screaming more about it, and I was pretty, verbal and visual and visible during that period of time. But, it is really this notion of of public schools not being an institution or an entity that is important to parents, the closer you get to a neighborhood, the more you see parents saying, I may not like all the crap I hear elsewhere, but I really love my kids' public schools and their teachers.
Hmm. And we should let listeners know that those voucher ballot measures went down in the last election, even in deep red states like Kentucky,
exactly,
and Nebraska.
Every single county in Kentucky voted those voucher measures down, mm-hmm, even though they voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump.
Today, we're talking with Randi Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, about her new book, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education and the Future of Democracy. Let's take a few callers who've been waiting patiently. Peter in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. Wonderful to hear Randi Weingarten. In my lifetime, the question of what is education for, when I was in school, I remember it seemed to be that it was to make a better citizen, a person who could enjoy and participate in the culture in which we live and which we share. And more and more, it seems as though there's a kind of selfish, you know, education is so that we can stay competitive as a country. Education is for individual enrichment, you know, graduates of whatever make so and so many $100,000 more over a lifetime than non-graduates. And it's become more and more a kind of competition and just for the individual to improve their economic circumstances. And I think that's a very poor trend, but I think it's something that one has to deal with in just talking about what is education for. What wonder what Randi thinks.
Thank you, Peter.
I think you're very prescient here. And you saw this in terms of the nature of what, you know, the federal education policies have been over the course of 249 years. If you listen, and again, I don't want to put the framers, the founders of our country on, you know, too much of a pedestal. I think that they deserve their due, and they actually, you know, founded this country and founded it as a democracy that we have now changed over the course of time to make it more free and more equal. Obviously, what they did with slavery was an anathema to everyone or to us. But they actually believed in education as a civic virtue. You saw that, and you saw that they believed that education was the bulwark against tyranny. And so we need to do both. And this country always kind of toggles between individualism, think about the frontier, the great frontier, and some kind of community basis, some kind of we the people, all of us together. And I think that ultimately education is for both. It's for how we build a nation and how we create a future for that nation and how individuals actually have the skills and knowledge they need to be prepared for college, career, life, and citizenship.
You also write that you believe that there's a fear of knowledge, of young people having agency, of young people thinking critically.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it is... Like, I remember, you know, maybe this ages me, you know, when we used to wear buttons called saying question authority. Like, of course you would question authority. I mean, that's part of being young. It's part of, you know, the cultural changes, the interesting, you know, what kids bring into society. Like, why would we fear kids having knowledge? And why would we fear kids having a different opinion than we have, or than I have? Kids in my classroom arriving at a different conclusion. My job, you know, as a classroom teacher, is to teach a young person how to think, not what to think, and to have the skills and knowledge to be able to navigate through his, her, or their worlds.
Well, thank you for the call, Peter. Let's go next to Doris in Berkeley. Hi, Doris. Thanks for holding.
Thank you so much. What an excellent program. Always, always excellent.
Thank you.
My comment is twofold. One, let's beware that it's not only Republicans, and I'm sounding partisan saying it this way, but it's not only Republicans who have practiced and enhanced their methodologies of autocratic approach to various public policies. I'm in Berkeley, and I will say in a very direct way that more and more of our elected officials, in fact, pretty much every elected official in Berkeley at this moment, is behaving in an autocratic way. They think because they got elected, they can just rule by edict. And they have meetings here and there specifically about the upzoning situation in Berkeley that's being put forward by various powerful people. They ask the neighbors to come to meetings. They, on some occasions, let the public speak, actually on a microphone. However, they're set in their decisions, it seems, and we're hoping to, shall I say, prove them wrong and insist that representative government doesn't mean because you're elected you do whatever you think is right, but you have to be responsible and respectful and inclusive of the businesses' interests and the general well-being of the commercial areas, because they are the mainstay of our financial well-being in any city and on the stability of the community at large. So autocracy is not just a one-party situation. I'll just say it like that.
Yeah, thank
you, Doris.
I
totally agree with you. Look, I left, you know, I was a long-standing member of the Democratic National Committee and had been asked to serve again, and I said no. And I mean, I'm not leaving the Democratic Party. I think that's where my home is, but for lots of different reasons. But, you know, we need to have, you do need to have more and more and more of a two-party or a multiple-party system. I've watched countries, sorry, I am a geek on government, but I watch parties, you know, I watch countries that have multiple parties. I'm not sure that they're better or than a two-party system, but the democracy requires that the will of the people be deeply respected. And yes, we have to protect, as Madison said, you know, we have to protect the rights of the minority, and we have to also make sure that we respect the will of the majority. And that is part of what democracy is. It's messy, but when it works, what happens is that even when people lose a vote, they respect the decision-making process that has happened.
Thank you so much, Doris. If there's anything you'd like us to cover around what's happening in Berkeley, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks for your comment. I know we have to let you go in a few minutes, Randy. Here's a good question from Sandra, who writes, San Francisco likes to think of itself as a fairly progressive city, yet 30% of school-aged children attend private school. Public schools are a place where all different kinds of people come together. If our children are only educated in bubbles, it's easier to demonize others. Right now in San Francisco, it's the window for young families to select schools. What would you say to families about the benefits of public schools for their kids?
So I've spent a bunch of time in San Francisco, and there is there's been a lot of issues and a lot of problems, particularly around the issues of funding and the huge cost of housing in so many areas in San Francisco and around. I would just say that there's lots of schools in San Francisco that are great places for young people. And I know that the educators there, I know several of them, many of them, they're my members. They do everything they can to help. They have not gotten the funding that they need over the course of the last few years, and that has really hurt in different schools. I've seen the effects of that. But I've been in classrooms in San Francisco. I'm remembering a music classroom that I was just in last year, where I was watching kids learn musical instruments. I was watching them learn how to sing in harmony. I was watching the faces of those kids as their teacher was helping prod them along. That's the beauty of education.
Hmm. Well, thank you for the email, Sandra. We have to let you go, Randy, but I just wonder, we are watching the Trump administration shut down the Department of Education. We didn't have time to talk about this, but people with disabilities are very concerned about the federal government, the Trump administration, laying off 400 people in a number of offices at the Department of Education.
Right.
With a specific focus on those who make sure that kids with disabilities get the education they deserve, and we'll do a show about that. What concerns you the most about Trump and the next 3 years?
Well, let me say two things. What concerns me the most is that the disregard of people and the abuse of power. And that what you just said is an example of it. We see it all the time with the militarization of streets. We see it all the time with the disappearing of people, particularly our immigrant neighbors in America. But it's the Congress, not the president, that gets to decide whether or not the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act should be denuded. And when you take away every person in a department that works on that issue, so that a parent in San Francisco who has a kid who has a disability and thinks that their IEP says that they should get a certain service and they're not getting it, and they try to call the Department of Education to see what they should do, and nobody is answering the phone call because nobody is there. That is getting rid of something that Congress has created, that the people in America, the parents in America, have an expectation will be followed. And that's the basic disrespect of human beings that I fear that the Trump administration has all the time. You see the same thing in terms of SNAP. You see the same thing in terms of healthcare premiums going through the roof. It's this notion that you're going to create more and more anxiety and fear, not caring about the effects of what the administration is doing, and not caring about the law that you took an oath to the Constitution to follow. That abuse of power is what I fear the most. Now, we can go to court, which we have, and frankly, for whoever asked that question, those people are back. We went to court, we got them back, at least temporarily, but that abuse of power, that disregarding of the human impact of what they are doing, that's what scares me the most.
Randy Weingarten is author of the new book, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education, and the Future of Democracy. She's been president of the American Federation of Teachers since 2008. Thank you so much for your work, Randy. Thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you. I so appreciate you, and I so appreciate NPR, and I so appreciate public radio and this deep dive that we could do. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks to Johanna Miyake for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can find all of our past shows at kalw.org. Click news and your call. Be sure to podcast our show. We're also putting some of our shows up on YouTube, so you can check those out and be sure to share them. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about what is happening with the government shutdown. So many people are afraid, they're concerned about how they're going to put food on the table, how they're going to pay their heating bills, how they're going to make ends meet. To think that federal workers are not receiving a paycheck, people who receive SNAP will not receive SNAP come November 1st. So many people across the Bay Area are really stepping up to provide free and discounted food. So on tomorrow's Your Call, we'll be talking about that and we'll be bringing you information about where you can go if you need assistance. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.